Aloha, it's 4 o'clock. You're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. It's time now for Out of the Box. I'm your host, Dave Giroux.
And I'm Jonathan Jay.
Coming in late.
I'm not late, Dave. I was cleaning the toilet and the refrigerator.
Wow, that's great.
Somebody's got to do those
things. Doing the work.
Yes. And empty the trash. That's right.
Really, volunteering here at the radio station.
Hey, you know what? Stuff's got to get done.
That's right. That's how it gets done.
Yep.
Okay, well, Out of the Box is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the following wonderful underwriters.
Alahale Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic, acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, electromagnetic cellular therapy, and spinal rehab. Most major health insurance plans and Medicare accepted. Open Monday through Friday, 332-5580 or online at kalahaochiropractic.com.
HawaiiGaga.com, Hawaii Vacation Rental Directory and Vacation Guide. A proud sponsor of Kauai Community Radio, Hawaii Gaga also publishes the Kauai GPS Tour Guide, an audio tour of Kauai for iPhones. More information online at HawaiiGaga.com.
Island Metals, Kauai's one-stop shop for all things metal roofing and siding. Manufacturing custom orders to your exact specifications in just 1 to 2 days. Right here on Kauai. Contractors and homeowners welcome. More information at 246-4600. Online at islandmetals.com or at our shop in Honolulu. At All Island Metals, we have you covered. The 7th Annual Red Clay Jazz Festival 2014 is June 25th through the 28th. Friday the 27th features Hawaii legends Jimmy Borges and Betty Lou Taylor, plus Slack Key Masters Ken Emerson and Will Bernard at the Kauai Beach Resort, starting at 7 p.m. Saturday the 28th features 7-time Grammy winner Diane Schur, the Chicago Blues Band, Mississippi Heat, and Swing Shift, plus food booths at the Kauai Lagoons, starting at 4 p.m. On Wednesday and Thursday, the 25th and 26th, there will be live performances around the island, plus educational workshops by the musicians. More information at 822-3148 or online at redclayjazz.org.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right.
Okay.
You know what?
What's that?
Sometimes, I can only speak for myself, but sometimes even the things that I say don't actually reflect my views or my opinions.
That's right. You can't believe everything you think.
Well, that's certainly true because I'm willing to listen to other people's perspectives and take in new information, and hopefully my thinking can evolve. But sometimes I just say things to try and start a conversation or to reflect views that I think aren't being well heard in the public discussion.
All right. If you haven't had time to think something all the way through, you just throw something out, see how it sounds. Like, you know, I've said something before. It's like, well, you know, it doesn't really sound right.
Wait a second. I don't agree with me.
Yeah, I don't agree with me on that. All right.
Well, we've got a great show for you today. We do. It's War and Peace on the Garden Island. We're here in the center of the Pacific Ocean, part of the area of responsibility of U.S. PACCOM, that's Pacific Command. It's 52% of the surface of the planet, of the Earth. It's got 6 out of the 10 largest economies in the world all around its periphery. It's got more than half the population in the world, and it goes from pole to pole, from ice cap to ice cap. So we'll be talking about war and peace in the Pacific, specifically here on the Garden Island. We've got 3 different guests lined up. Captain Bruce Hay, commanding officer of the Pacific Missile Firing Range. We've got Kyle Kajihiro, a longtime committed peace activist, and a journalist, John Lettman, who will be coming in after that to sort of help put war and peace in perspective. John Lettman is very proud of saying he's no expert, but what he is an effective communicator. So hopefully he can help explain some of the stuff that are talked about with Captain Hay and Kyle Kajihiro. So That's pretty exciting. But
all right.
Yeah. But, of course, we've got the top of the show. Dave likes to start off with recent news around the world. So take it away, Dave.
Okay. What's going on in the world? Actually, Vince, kind of chaotic in the world right now.
Chaos can be beautiful.
Not in this case, unfortunately.
I just want to speak up for chaos because chaos gets a bad name sometimes.
Are you talking about the International Crime Organization Get Smart is out after?
Chaos.
You know, that was a great show.
What was that? It stood for something. KOS. I forget what the acronym stood for.
I think it stood for chaos.
Maybe it did. I thought there was some other meaning to it.
Well, that was a funny show. It poked fun at some of the Cold War sensibilities.
Yeah. I liked it when they got into the cone of silence.
I like the cone of silence, too.
They couldn't hear each other.
Yeah. Well, because it was silent inside the cone.
Well, it's supposed to be silent outside the cone, not inside.
That was a funny show.
They didn't get that one.
I like that show.
Okay. Hey, I want to tell you about a study came out about 6 months or so ago by the New England Complex Systems Institute.
That sounds complicated.
Yeah, they look at relationships among different things that are going on around the world. And one of the things, they found a causal relationship between critically high food prices and social unrest.
Oh, let me guess. It wasn't social unrest that was causing the critical high food prices.
No, as a matter of fact, it was the other way around.
Huh.
When food prices, according to the UN, United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's Food Price Index, whenever the index reached a certain point, then there was a lot more social unrest.
So let me try and translate what you just said to make sure I understood it correctly.
Okay.
When prices of necessities like food got too high, people went crazy.
They got upset.
Okay.
And they started protesting. And this
that makes sense.
Actually happened, you know, in the big Arab Spring uprisings, which I think was mischaracterized anyway. But
leave it to our corporate media to get the story wrong.
Right, yeah. But we're looking at time frame 2008 or 2007 or so is when the Arab Spring uprisings began.
Was it that long ago?
The very first protests were about food prices.
Mm.
Okay, and then it kind of spun out of control, and then the government started crushing them and crushing the rebellions, and then there was backlash and all kinds of other things. But the real trigger point was food prices at that time, especially in Egypt and
Tunisia,
I think, were the two that started off that. But anyway, so they found a relationship. So when food prices go up to a certain point, then there's social unrest.
And that makes sense.
And according to their study, if current trends continue, we will permanently cross the barrier at which social unrest begins as early as July next month.
I imagine this isn't in every single place in the world, but in which regions?
Well, but with globalized trade, you know, food prices go up everywhere.
Sure, but who's the hardest hit? Because not everybody.
Prices can go up one place, people are wealthy enough to absorb that,
sure.
Then they're not going to die as a result of it, but in other parts of the world, they may. So what's causing the run-up in prices then?
Actually, that's a good question.
And this paper said there were two causes. One was speculators causing price bubbles,
so market forces.
Corn to ethanol conversion is another factor that's really raising food prices.
Oh, right, because then instead of growing food, they're growing fuel.
Yeah, so they're taking the food supply, taking a slice out of the food supply and using it to produce ethanol.
Well, why don't people just eat or drink ethanol instead?
Well, they do, too much can be bad for you, though.
Huh.
But anyway, there's a Goldman Sachs a few years ago. They're another one implicated in this increase in food prices.
I'm guessing they're the speculators.
Created an index fund which pegs commodity futures, including corn and other and wheat. And so people started betting on the food prices to go up or down.
Okay, so this is market forces entering into the market to try and extract profit.
Right. And so they're buying and selling commodities to make a profit, holding on to some so that their prices go up.
Huh.
And a lot of people are just
gaming the system.
Are just playing this game and it's running the food prices way up.
Huh.
And so
well, that seems like that's good for Wall Street but bad for hungry people.
That's right, you know. So you know, this is a very serious thing, and it may not be the only problem going on, and the only reason for social unrest in the world. For example, it's not really what's going on in Ukraine, for that matter.
Sure.
There is a lot of speculation going on in Ukraine right now, and it seems to be, it's not really, I mean, there is the push and pull of, you know, geopolitical forces.
Sure, the expansion of NATO forces into former Soviet
dependencies. And, you know, Russia trying to stop that,
sure,
you know, from going into their
different their economic
doorstep.
Blocks. Sure.
But the oligarchs, you know, the rich people in that area.
Now, you're talking about
betting
the American oligarchs, or whose oligarchs?
Well, it's kind of like it's become a battleground between our oligarchs and their oligarchs.
I'm rooting for our oligarchs.
Your oligarchs are in charge right now.
Oh, good.
The new president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, is an agent of the U.S. government. He worked for the State Department, and he's also a billionaire.
Huh.
And so he was just elected, which I find very suspicious. There were 23 candidates in that election, and he got 54% of the vote in the primary.
Are you suspicious because 23 candidates is a prime number, or what triggered your suspicion?
Well, with that many candidates, it's really hard to get over 50%, you know, in any election. Imagine, you know, county council, something like that. You got 23 candidates, and
actually
somebody gets.
We do have 20.
So I doubt if anyone will get 50% of the vote in that election, because, you know, with that many candidates, you get spread out. Usually they take the top two or three and they have a runoff in November.
Right.
Okay, with this one here, so Poroshenko got 55% of the vote.
Wait, did he just get 54%? And then are you stretching the story?
It was 54.7. So,
okay, you can round that to 55. I'll give you that.
So,
fact-check you, Dave.
I'm a little suspicious of the fact that he got in there. I don't think that it was a fair election.
And maybe he was just very popular.
And plus, only 15% of the people in eastern Ukraine even voted. They closed the ballot boxes, the polling places, and they didn't let anyone vote. So it wasn't a fair election, and our oligarch won. And so they're kind of fighting over oil prices. Natural gas prices, all the mines and everything that they own in there. One of these oligarchs has 300,000 employees in his mining and transportation enterprises, that sort of thing.
What have you got against the job creator, Dave?
Well, anybody who accumulates that much money through transactions is a drain on the economy. I mean, like the Waltons in the U.S.
Okay. I love that TV show, John Boy and Mary Ellen.
The Walmart family.
Different Waltons.
Three or four of these family members that are all billionaires, some of the richest people in the world now, because, you know, of Walmart. You know, they take a lot of money out of the company. And so...
Those are called profits, Dave.
Well... But they are a drain on the economy because that money gets sucked out of the economy. It's not paid to fair wages for their employees. You know, it's not, you know, reducing the prices to the consumers. It's all going into their pockets. And so they are,
What have you got against free market capitalism, Dave?
Well, I do have a big problem about the...
What have you got against the hyper-wealthy who, you know, taking resources from everyone else? What have you got against them for that?
For that reason... Because they're taking resources from everybody else. There's plenty of resources on the planet for everybody, but we have a situation now that has never existed in the history of the planet, history of humans on the planet, where a very small group of people have such extreme levels of wealth. And so it is the cause of most of the problems in the world, I would say. And so I believe that... We got to get rid of these oligarchs. We got to change the system to where it's more equitable. And so I do have something against them.
All right. Well, I think it's honest of you to own that.
Right. And so, you know, another big situation going on is in Iraq.
Oh, right. I heard that there's a destabilizing events taking place in northern Iraq.
Yes. And so chaos is taking over Iraq.
Well, actually, it's not chaos. It's the imposition of an order that U.S. military planners don't like, which isn't the same thing as chaos.
But I think the intention of the entire conflict there was to create chaos. That is what the U.S. foreign policy is.
Well, then
take a peaceful, organized country and turn it into a chaotic situation.
Well,
look at all of the situations that we've been involved with, you know, over the last 50 years, you know, since Vietnam, you know, create chaos. You know, Iraq, create chaos. You know, Czechoslovakia. Libya.
What was Czechoslovakia?
Serbia. You know, don't you remember our bombing campaign there in the 90s?
No.
We just destabilized that whole region.
You mean the Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia.
Not Czechoslovakia.
Okay.
Fact check your facts, Dave.
Hey.
That's why I like to try to keep you honest.
Serbia.
Okay. Yeah.
Serbia and
Croatia.
Croatia.
Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Right. Yeah.
Not Czechoslovakia.
And then Libya, Syria, Ukraine now, you know, that's a U.S. Operation there. So anyway, Iraq is descending into chaos. I don't know if it's been chaotic ever since we invaded them.
It seems like it's been chaotic ever since the democratically elected government was overthrown by, I believe, CIA operatives back in the late 50s, early 60s, and that's when Saddam came into power. Or maybe that was in the 70s, a little bit before my time.
Yeah. So anyway, these are not related to food prices necessarily, but they are chaos going on in the world. So that's just a snapshot of what's going on in a couple places there. There's, another news item here. There was an election in Nevada a couple of days ago. It was a gubernatorial primary.
I didn't realize that we were bringing democracy to Nevada. That's exciting.
We're trying.
News. Okay,
we're trying.
Well, good.
But anyway, since 1975, Nevada has had a law that that on every ballot, you'll have your candidates that have stepped forward, and then there'll always be an option for none of the above.
That's my favorite religious candidate.
None of the above. Yeah.
Her work. She's really done a lot of good in the world.
If you don't like the other candidates in there, you vote for none of the above.
That's my favorite none. I like.
And so
I think she was one of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
In the gubernatorial primary for the Democratic Party in Nevada, none of the above actually won.
Oh, wow.
They won, but with like 24% of the vote.
Well, that's not suspicious, right?
Okay. No, that's not suspicious.
That's not like
all.
54.7%.
Because, you know, the candidates were weak, you know, and nobody liked them. So just said, you know, give us some more candidates.
Maybe she
know?
Ran a very strong campaign.
Well, often does, you know, and I think this ought to be the case everywhere. If you don't like the candidates, then you should be able to just say, get rid of them all. Bring us some people that are more experienced and, better candidates.
Huh.
And so the head of the Democratic Party in Nevada is Harry Reid.
Oh, I've heard of him. He's the senator.
He's a senator.
Is he senator or congressman?
I don't remember.
Harry Reid. I think he's the Senate. He's in the Senate.
Senator,
he's the Senate Majority Leader.
So anyway, he then had the option to name the who will be the candidate in November.
Why does he get to decide?
Well, because he's ahead of the party. You know?
So, but the people and voted for none of the above.
This is the way it works. And unfortunately, I think this is a downfall of this policy, this none of the above policy, is that now they can just name somebody who might be worse than the people that are on the ballot.
Because, I mean,
kicked off,
if people vote for none of the above, to me that seems that that's the will of the people. They're not voting for let Harry Reid decide.
Well, and that's what happens a lot of times. Even here, you know, when somebody steps down, you know, like from council or who we've had recently.
Mason Chalk got appointed.
Mina Morita stepped down.
Derek Kawakami got appointed.
Got appointed, yeah.
Right.
So I don't think that anybody should ever be appointed to any elected position that they ought to. If somebody steps down, there's a void there. There ought to be an election.
What have you got against appointments? I mean, isn't that like making a promise to someone that you'll meet them at a certain time?
Well, it's not representative government at that point. Then it's they're just naming their own successors there. You know, and so anyway, Harry Reid then named Robert Goodman, who was the runner-up in the ballot. So he was one of the people that they said, no, we don't like him, and so we're going to call for none of that. And so he named him to be the candidate.
So I guess kind of a
flaw in their policy there.
Well,
I don't think it worked out the way that they had hoped that none of the above policy would work.
I thought at the beginning of the story you were saying that we were bringing democracy to Nevada.
Yeah. No. I didn't say that. You might have said that.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Right. So anyway, now Robert Goodman will be running against Brian Sandoval, who is the Republican governor, current governor, who, you know, is very popular or very powerful and will likely win anyway. But it's just kind of these kind of shenanigans with government do not sit well with me. They don't give me confidence in our system of government.
Huh. Seems like you have a bias towards democracy, Dave.
Yeah. Let the people decide. That's what I say.
Huh.
Okay.
That's kind of a radical position.
I know it. Yeah. It shouldn't be, but evidently I'm in the minority on that one. But phone lines are open, 826-7771. We've only got a few more minutes before our first guest comes on. But let's see. We've also had... this is an interesting story. Came out last week. VW, Volkswagen Automobile Company, has just released a...
The people's car.
Yeah. They just released a model that they started producing there. And it's a hybrid diesel and electric vehicle. And it gets 300 miles to the gallon.
Sounds anti-American.
Well, they won't be selling it here in this country.
Well, that's good because it seems like that would have a destabilizing economic impact on our country and the economy. I mean,
for the oligarchs.
Well, what if everybody started driving around in cars that got 300 miles per gallon?
It'd be awesome. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having the show. My name's Aurelius. I'm an island resident. I've actually spoken on KKCR before about the big companies like Monsanto and stuff like that. When I heard the conversation going in that direction, I really wanted to add to your listeners, when you start to speak about this kind of critical mass, when food prices go up, it's a very specific ratio of people that can no longer afford to eat the basics, then you get this kind of average point of food prices where you get unrest. I just wanted to point out that last year when we shifted away from kind of a really big, like, Occupy-based protest, and we had more and more of these anti-GMO protests, one of the first ways, aside from trying to sue us county by county, one of the first things that Monsanto did to react to this was they made a huge purchase, and they purchased Blackwater, which is the largest private security firm in the world. So basically, right. I just want to make sure everybody know that Monsanto purchased their own private army.
Now, they changed the name of it, too.
This isn't very serious. Like, you can fact-check that all day.
Right, yeah, they changed their name of it.
They changed it to something unpronounceable.
Well, it used to be XI.
Yeah.
And then they changed it again to Academy.
Academy.
Yeah, and they're now working...
That sounds smart.
They're now working in the Ukraine.
Huh.
Right. Yeah, well, these companies change their names all the time. That's why it's up to us to educate ourselves.
Well, I'm glad, caller. I'm glad, caller, that you are keeping your same name as you call in to the station from time to time. It's community radio, community airwaves. It's awesome that you're using your airwaves.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys making the time. I love you guys all the time. And what can I say? Mahalo for putting this on the airwaves.
How would you respond to the claims that GMO companies make that they're helping with the problem of food prices because they're bringing more food products to the market and thereby reducing the cost of food and making it more affordable? In a sense, I hear them claim that they are feeding the world.
Yeah, we hear this a lot. And it's the same claim that echoes from really the same families of companies that have changed their names a lot since the 70s when they first introduced Big Ag as the Green Revolution. And this was supposed to, you know, industrialize food production and make food prices very, very cheap. So my first answer is that food prices have been skyrocketing ever since these, you know, military-related, you know, remember, all these chemicals, all these lovely pesticides and stuff became available and were originally developed as wartime, you know, chemical weapons. And then when we entered a more peaceful time, they needed to keep selling it. So they took things that were, like, based on things like Agent Orange and, you know, companies that evolved into Syngenta. And they're basically, they don't sell food. They sell chemicals to their partner companies.
Well,
companies make sure that they consume a certain amount of chemicals.
Sure. In fairness, I think they do both.
Correct. They sell a lot more. They make a lot more money off of chemicals than they do off of food. But as we all know, when we go into Walmart, food's really not that cheap. And it's also not cut down on the pesticides. These GMO foods, use 10 times more pesticides than they did 10 years ago. And so it's the food's not safer, it's not cheaper, and prices are not going down anywhere in the world. Prices are continuing to rise on food. So I would say that's a big BS to that.
Well, I would think that the companies that you mentioned would respond that they just have successful and savvy business practices, and that that's good for the economy and it's good for the shareholders that have invested in them. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would respond to that by saying, yes, it's been very profitable to their investors. But again, like I heard one of you say earlier, that sounds like good news for Wall Street and bad news for hungry people. I think if you look at their business practices, and they claim these practices are healthy for a good food economy, they sue farmers out of their land in order to take it away from them. They use 20% of our land right here on Kauai. 20% of our arable land is being used by these companies not to grow food, but to grow seeds that are patented, and therefore that they own the patent on these seeds. So every business move they make is taking control of the food supply, is doing nothing to help the food supply except direct all those profits directly into their pockets.
Well, I really thank you for being able to, kind of respond on the spot to some of these questions. I don't think that these are easy issues. It seems like there's some complexity to try and understand the sometimes counterintuitive impact of stuff.
A lot of your listeners might recognize my name. I'm fairly new to the island. My name is Aurelius. I've been here a year and a half, but I've really made it my business. I've had private meetings with Gary Hooser. I've been to a lot of these events. I'm constantly socially networking, and part of my job is to articulate these things. I have conversations like this on the bus all the time, in line at the grocery store. And my main message, now that I've got a little minute on the airways, is people do need to educate themselves. They need to make it their business, and they do need to talk to their friends and neighbors about it, because when the information, which I've drawn from, is publicly available information, once a certain critical mass of people get these big guys' game, the voting process will be very simple. The litigation process will be very, very simple. There's a very few people that are responsible for the jam up on the island. And let's not forget, while they're buying up and leasing up our land to produce these GMO seeds, they're also dumping over 100 million tons of Roundup, atrazine, as well as 22 other untested chemicals that are going into our ground and our air right now. We know nothing about. We have to stand up and say, it's not up to us to prove that it's unsafe. It's up to them to prove that it is safe. That is consumer protection.
Well, I guess I'd like to sort of question you on some of your numbers, but we'll save that for another time. I want to thank you for calling in. We're going to move on to our next segment in the show, but thank you again for calling into Out of the Box.
Okay, well, I'll just say that if any of my numbers are wrong, when you look them up, you'll find that they're close and they're shocking.
Well, I think check the 100 million tons. I think that sounds a little high, because these numbers have been reported, but I think they were in the...
It might be 100 million pounds, but then there's also the discrepancy of how much of this is concentrate and how much is our water been used to water it down.
Well, thank you for calling in. We'll follow that up and get back to this topic. It's an important topic, so we'll be covering it more in the future. Thank you.
Okay, I'll make it a point to tune into your show and call in if I've got any more to add.
Fantastic.
Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, here it is in a nutshell. Let's say you're making $10 an hour, which is
not enough.
$2 over the minimum wage,
yeah,
or something like that.
Not a living wage.
Okay, $10 an hour, 40 hours a week. And, Walmart won't give you that because they don't want to pay benefits, so you'll only get, a 28-hour week or something, Anyhow, the cost of rent for even a small studio apartment over here is $900, $800 to $900. Then the cost of food is going to be a easy $100 a week. Then your cost of your electricity, probably about anywhere from $200 to $300 a month. How can you, the guys in jail are doing better than the people out working.
Well, I think you've raised some interesting points. We don't have a lot of time right in this minute to kind of go into some of that, because we've got another guest who's going to be calling
in pretty soon. I understand, but everything I said is true. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree with your numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, caller. We're going to go to some music right now, and in a few moments we'll come back with Captain Bruce Hayes, the commanding officer of PMRF, the Pacific Missile Firing Range. So stay tuned to Out of the Box here on KKCR, Kauai Community Radio, the station that loves you. Our next guest joining us here on Out of the Box on KKCR is Captain Bruce Hayes, a former native of Hyde Park, New York, graduated from Union College in Schenectady, New York, where he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Industrial Economics. Inspired by the film Top Gun, he became a naval flight officer in 1999. He's also served on the nuclear aircraft carriers USS Abraham Lincoln, the USS Nimitz. He's been involved at U.S. Strategic Command at the Joint Warfare Analysis Center, investigating the future aircraft carrier requirements as an officer at the Chief of Naval Operations. He's a decorated combat veteran and has been awarded numerous meritorious service medals from the Navy and Marine Corps. Has served over 2,600 flight hours in the Northrop Grumman EA-6B Prowler, an electronic warfare attack aircraft designed for the suppression of enemy air defenses, and has over 800 carrier-arrested landings. Commanding officer of the Pacific Missile Range since July of 2013, Captain Bruce, it's an honor to have you on as a guest on Kauai Community Radio. Welcome to Out of the Box.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. As a neighbor on our tiny island, I think it's really great for people to understand exactly what goes on at the PMRF. What goes on at the Pacific Missile Firing Range?
Pacific Missile Range Facility.
Oh, thank you. Sorry.
Just as a point of clarification, and actually won't be that much longer before we go through a name change to the Inouye Pacific Range Facility in honor of the late senator, who was a huge advocate and supporter of the range. But if you've been paying attention to the local newspaper and NASA and stuff, we tried to launch a test vehicle for the Mars rover program, and the warm, sticky weather we have here is indicative of the unusual weather that we've been experiencing. And unfortunately, we had to cancel that. They'll be back at the end of this month to try again.
I read that you were scheduled to do that as early as Saturday, and you're talking about the so-called Martian UFO.
That's a low-density supersonic decelerator. It was two test platforms embedded in one. The idea was to figure out in the very thin Martian atmosphere how to slow payloads down. And it's a combination of an inflatable ring. That's a low-density supersonic decelerator.
I love all the names. It just it blows me away.
Yeah, that's NASA. I can't claim that.
Okay.
Provides the initial deceleration and then a parachute that would deploy at supersonic speeds. The idea is to increase the size of the payloads.
Sure, to deliver heavier scientific equipment to Mars.
Or to go to the more inhospitable parts of Mars. So if you look at Mars Rover, it's sort of like the flatness of Kansas, but there are other parts that are like the middle of Colorado, and you want to try and get to those as well. So this is a, you know, a technology demonstration to facilitate that kind of exploration. They'll be back later. Right now we're supporting some ships from the Republic of Korea who are out here testing their equipment, the ability to track and understand what's going on around the ships. And, of course, as everyone's aware, we're gearing up for support to the Rim of the Pacific exercise, which will bring 23 partner nations plus a fairly large contingent of the U.S. Navy to the Hawaiian operating area.
I understand there's also going to be, for the first time, Chinese ships involved in RIMPAC. That's a little bit new. Maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, correct. So there's four ships, actually. One of them is their hospital ship. So they have a hospital ship, sort of like our two giant hospital ships, Mercy and the Comfort, that we deploy for something called humanitarian aid and disaster relief.
Something called humanitarian aid.
Yeah. Pardon?
I'm just making sure I heard you correctly. You said something called humanitarian aid.
And disaster relief. That's what we call it when we deploy ships like that. So if there's a major disaster someplace, we deploy the Comfort or the Mercy to help support the civilian authorities who are responsible for, you know, recovering from those events.
Were those the former Super Ferry vessels?
No, they are gigantic ships. Look, think of the cruise ships that come into Noili Willy Harbor, paint them gray, and then put a giant red cross on them.
Okay.
So that's what their hospital ships. If you took Wilcox and turned it into a ship, it's the same idea, operating rooms, and all the, you know, equipment that you would need to provide medical care post some kind of major event like a tsunami or an earthquake or something like that. That's accessible from the ocean. But they're bringing four ships. One of them is their hospital ship, and then they have three other surface ships. And what's, I think, interesting about this is we don't have any treaties or hotlines or anything like we had during the Cold War era with the former Soviet Union to avoid conflicts at sea. And just recently, over 20 nations signed something called a Code for Unplanned Encounters at Sea.
Is there an acronym for that?
CUES.
I love military acronyms.
Yeah, so the idea is, not everyone speaks English, obviously, but the ability to communicate basic intentions of ships so that you don't end up scraping paint and causing something to escalate when there is no need to escalate. So,
sure, you want to all play nice with one another.
Absolutely. So, Rim of the Pacific with the People's Republic of China gives us an opportunity to establish those dialogues and practice those kind of things so that you know, we can all enjoy the giant Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, the whole watery half of the world. Well, I suppose it's good. Stuff like that is good for developing trust and building working relationships, and I think that's probably something everybody could feel a lot better about than you know, saber rattling and bristling and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the Rim of the Pacific exercise brings all the countries together, and you know, part of the partnering involves things as benign as sports competitions between the crews of the ships. There's receptions, there's dialogues. And not every nation has a navy the size of the United States. So.
Actually, I think no nation has a navy the size of the United States.
All right, fair enough. I'll give you that. So the nations with ships that are smaller, we participate with coastal security, Coast Guard-type activities, anti-piracy ops. So there's all kinds of things that don't necessarily bring, you know, military to the forefront. It's enforcement and enjoyment of the ocean for everybody. And those are great relationships to establish. So RIMPAC helps us facilitate that.
Well, PMRF, thank you for correcting me, the Pacific Missile Range Facility, is described as the world's largest multidimensional testing and training range. How big is that? Big is big?
All right, so the land side is actually pretty small. We're about 7.5 miles long by 3/4, but the ocean space that we utilize. There's two of them. Our normal range complex is 42,000 square miles, so roughly half the size of the state of Texas.
Or maybe the size of Pennsylvania or Tennessee.
And if you've ever had the pleasure of driving east or west on I-10, you know how big that is, even half of that. And then that sits inside a larger extended complex of 2.1 million square miles. So take the continental United States, everything west of Mississippi, and to include Baja, Mexico, and that whole area is an area that we can utilize for certain test events. So don't use that very often, but we have the capability to take advantage of that that space.
Well, I looked it up on the internet, and it says that 2.1 million square miles is approximately the size of the Amazonian rainforest. And I guess I, for one, am glad that you're doing your testing and range activity in the open ocean and not in the Amazon rainforest.
There's it is a lot of water in the Amazon, but not the kind that we need to float ships, obviously.
Well, you've described some of the challenges that you face at PMRF as having to do with cash flow, operating as a business. And you said in an earlier interview with the Garden Island that, you know, as a warrior, you would operate a weapon system, get into an airplane or a ship, and just do your mission. But now you have to focus on the fiscal part, the financial aspect of it. And as a person creating the business and attracting customers to PMRF, how is that a challenge for you? And what are some of the new challenges that you're facing? Because aren't we in a climate where funding is kind of drying up?
Yes and yes for that, and I'll expand upon that. So if you're familiar with the kids' movie Cars, have you seen that? It's an animated movie.
I can't say that I have.
Oh, you're missing out as a car person and as a, you know, suffice it to say, we're like a small town that a highway was built north of and no off-ramp was put to get off the highway near that town. And that highway was the conduit of forces flowing from the mainland to the desert environment after the first Gulf War. And the Pacific Missile Range Facility, which up to that point had been very focal in training the Navy and Marine Corps team and stuff, you know, saw all those people, you know, bustering by as they had to get someplace in a relatively short period of time. Well, now that we're leaving the desert environment and focusing on the Pacific, we're building that off-ramp again so that people remember that you have an ability to train in the Pacific environment and right where you're going to be. And, you know, the first Gulf War was 23 years ago. A typical military career is only about 20 years, so their whole generation of people basically never heard of the Pacific Missile Range Facility. And just reminding people that we're more than test and evaluation, and that's good business and it's important work, but we also, you know, we have the ability to train in a very realistic environment, and I think that's important. It's already paid for, no new money required to take advantage of what's already here, so that's starting to resonate, and we can see it with the amount of business we're doing right now, which is a good problem to do. And it's not at any additional cost to anybody.
Captain, hey, this is Dave Jerome. And I wonder, I'm not sure how much time you have here. I was hoping that we would be able to open up the phone lines and get a couple of callers in if you had time to take some questions from our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And okay. Then I know you're going to talk with John later, who had an opportunity to come out here and tour the base. Proud of the people that work here and the work that we do, and I encourage people to explore what we do and ask questions and come out here through our public affairs folks and kind of see for themselves. So if they don't get a chance to ask me a question, that opportunity always exists. And I said proud of the people and the things that we do here, so right. Please take advantage of those. And one quick pitch, on the 3rd of July we're having a America's Most West Freedom Fest. It'll be open to everybody. So if you didn't get an opportunity at any other point during your time here on Kauai to come out here, please join us on the 3rd of July for four bands and fireworks. Gates open at 4.
You certainly have the expertise of shooting things up into the sky and making pretty explosions, so I imagine that will be an excellently executed event.
Yes, that's our goal, safe and enjoyable.
Well, bringing you onto the air is part of our mission, part of our reaching out to help you exactly with that, to try and connect the community with what you're doing on the base.
So, Captain, how many civilian employees are there at PMRF? And what, if you know, what is the economic impact to the island here, would you say?
Right. Of 1,000 people that work on base, about 900 of them are civilian and have worked here their whole lives, 25, 35, 45 years. And I think that's pretty interesting. If you are interested in national defense, training, science, all kinds of other things, but you don't want to wear a uniform, live in a foxhole, or, you know, get on a ship.
Well, that doesn't accurately describe what you guys, you don't live in foxholes, do you?
No, but that's my point. You don't have to. You can still be involved with training our forces and not have to get on a ship or eat MREs. So 90% of the population here is civilian, and we are the largest technical employer on island, third largest overall. And our economic impact varies depending on the amount of test and evaluation events, RIMPAC, those kind of things. But it's well in excess of $150 million per year to the local economy.
Well, yeah, that's certainly helpful. And I know you guys have a lot of educational outreach programs through the schools and the conservation programs and stuff like that. But I'm curious, for the approximately 2,400 acres that you guys occupy out there on the Mana Plain, how do you contribute directly to the county economy in terms of taxes, or to the state economy in terms of your lease agreement fees, the annual lease that you have for those state administered lands?
Well, I can't talk to the tax basis of the property here, since it's federal property on a state island. But I know that the 1,000 employees that work here pay their property taxes. We pay all the taxes when we buy stuff out in town. You know, there's no special provision that allows us to, you know, avoid those. So it's like any other person. If you work for Costco or, you know, pick a company that's on island, you know, the same rules apply.
I'm pretty sure they don't have leases in perpetuity or till 2029, where they pay very, very little for that land.
Now the 2029s are a reference, obviously, to the Agricultural Preservative Initiative, which are the former Kekaha sugar property lands east of the base, which we maintain the pumps and the canals that were put in by sugar many, many, many years ago in exchange to avoid things that would interfere with our ability to our mission. So it basically ensures that land will remain only used for agriculture at least until 2029.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate you being available to answer questions. We got a caller right now who's called in with a question.
Okay.
Aloha, caller. Welcome to Out of the Box. You have a question for Captain Bruce, the commanding officer of PMRF.
Hi, Bruce. How are you today?
Good.
I just stepped in, you know, and, you know, I mean, I wish everybody good luck. When I was a kid, my dad reminded me that people die on both sides of the war, you know, and so I'm not going to try to judge who's right or who's wrong, you know, when it comes to war right now, because my life's pretty good, and I'm grateful for it. But, you know, I heard a key phrase that, we are going to take advantage of what we have here, and I'm thinking, well, who's we? You know, I'm not sure you're speaking for the Native Hawaiian people, that most of which would probably love to see the military go home, except for those people that have jobs out at your base, you know. And then, even though you do give money to these 1,000 or so employees, you know, I sit here kind of in paradise wondering who needs money, you know, especially when we're the U.S. economy is at our throats, and I wish we could live without it. You know, I'd like to live like the way the old Hawaiians used to live, frankly. But I mean, these aren't questions.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you have a question for...
Here's a question. Okay. What do you think of today's news that really says basically there's civil war in Iraq? You know, after billions of dollars in U.S., you know, funded military basically exercises in Iraq after U.S. civilian casualties, you know, the civilian casualties in Iraq maybe numbered a million. You know, I mean, what did we accomplish in Iraq compared to what are you going to try to accomplish in any future wars?
Well, thank you for your call. Caller, we're going to let the captain answer and let you listen on air.
Okay, thanks for your question. I appreciate it. So I understand your question is, what do I think about what's going on currently in Iraq and Mosul and Tikrit? Is that correct?
Is that above your pay grade, or how does that work?
Obviously, that's a decision that I have no influence on. That would be the State Department and above, and how we continue to involve ourselves in the affairs of the country of Iraq. I mean, I could talk as a private citizen, but that's not why you have me on here. So,
well, I mean, if you have a personal opinion, feel free to share it if you wish.
I'll stick to my job. And why you called me here today.
Okay.
I'd be more than happy to entertain those questions some other time.
As you wish.
So, sorry that was not answered. It's not within my purview, but it is a good question.
All right, well, that's fair enough. How about this question? In 1962, during the height of the Cold War, as part of Operation Dominic, PMRF was involved in the largest nuclear weapons testing program ever conducted by the United States, which included nuclear explosions visible in the nighttime skies over Honolulu. But the mission of PMRF has changed and evolved greatly over the decades, and it's not even just weapons systems that you do today. Who are your clients today?
Okay. So my command structure is I work for the Pacific Fleet Commander on Oahu, and my clients, for lack of a better term, are the forces of the United States and our allied partners who come out here to train. We also do test and evaluation for the Department of Defense, and we also support other governmental agencies like NASA, non-governmental agencies like the University of Hawaii. We are going to be launching something called Super Stripey in the fall.
What is that?
It's a commercial microsatellite program.
Okay, and what is that? Please forgive me, but...
No, it's awesome. It is a 500-pound payload microsatellite. It'll be used for research and inside a 1,000-pound lift body. It'll be launched from the south part of the base here, and will be used to support the Science and Technology Department at the University of Hawaii. It's a cooperation with the Office of Responsive Space, which you could think of as Air Force. And that will be launching here in November.
Office.
The idea is if you miniaturize the payload, you miniaturize the lift body, you miniaturize the cost of getting things into space.
So this is going into space?
Correct. And the second order effects here are, if this is successful, and by all accounts it should be, it could provide a long-term basis for space launches and jobs associated with science and technology for people here on Kauai and throughout Hawaii. So if you're at UH Manoa and you want to pursue something in the space industry, you'd have to go get a job on the mainland. Now there's a possibility that you could stay here in the Hawaiian Islands and pursue those career dreams. So I have high hopes for that program, and that'll launch sometime in November. We'll much like the NASA program, Low Density Supersonic Decelerator, will be widely publicized.
Cool. Well, we've got another caller standing by. If you'd like to take another question. Aloha, caller. Welcome to Out of the Box on KKCR. Do you have a question or a comment for Captain Bruce of the PMRF?
No, I actually have a couple of them, a question and a comment, too. And just thanks, Bruce, for getting on the air and talking about this subject. Hold on for a second. I'm going to turn off the damn radio.
Can you please turn your radio down?
Let me turn off. Hey, Bruce, I'm a marine biologist here in Kauai, studying the marine life and the reefs and whales and dolphins and heavy-duty coral disease that we have that's broken out throughout our entire island here in Kauai. And for 20 years now, I've been studying the effects of electromagnetic radiation on different marine life, including coral polyps all the way through to dolphins, you know, and seals and whales. The amount of radar and sonar and microwave that the Navy's using right now off the coast of Kauai here is pretty out there. I mean, it's more than probably ever been used anywhere in the world. So I just have kind of two questions for you, but would love to open up a dialogue way beyond the show right now. Are you folks in your warfare games in the giant part of the ocean where you're doing all these exercises, are you following the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Act, and the Migratory Bird Act?
Absolutely. We don't get to pick and choose which rules that we follow, unfortunately, and those are...
Well, actually, that seems like a fortunate thing, yeah?
Yeah, so the good thing is we comply with all the rules about environmental impact. And,
well, I just read, Bruce, and I don't mean to contradict you here. You're an expert in what you do with the military. I'm an expert in what I do with studying coral reefs and marine life. And I would love to just sit down with you in person and talk about this in a very friendly way. But according to President Obama, what I heard last is he voided out the Migratory Bird Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Endangered Species Act in your 800,000 square miles of ocean off the coastline here. So you can take and or kill accidentally whales, dolphins, marine life, coral reefs, whatever. Is that true?
No, and I'd love to show you the evidence to support that, to include the lights and other things that we do to protect migratory birds during nesting season here, to include shearwaters. This was the first year that the base had no fallouts. We have our friends on the west side who actually bring shearwaters that have fallen out due to cultural lighting in other parts of the island.
And I'm well aware of that, Bruce, above land. But let me just ask you a direct question. And
sure.
I'll just ask it to you very direct, and I've got the proof and the data to show what's going on here. Are you folks studying the effects of electromagnetic radiation putting out by your warfare equipment, your towers, your submarines, on marine life under the water, meaning coral reefs?
Well, thank you, caller, for those questions. I think we're going to let the captain answer that, and thank you for calling in.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Those were excellent questions. I'm not aware of the tie between Doppler, pulse Doppler radar, which is, I believe, he's referencing, and its transmission into water and effect on undersea life. That is not something I'm an expert on, but I'd be more than happy to entertain his questions offline if you want to connect the two of us.
All right. Well, I think, caller, if you're still listening, the PMRF is pretty easy to get a hold of. I had zero trouble looking them up in the phone book or online, so I encourage you to follow up with that. I guess we're kind of coming to the end of the segment, and I was curious if, from a philosophical perspective, obviously you've had your entire career in the military, and I'm sure that's something that you're quite proud of. But I'm wondering if we weren't spending all of the money that we are in military endeavors and testing weapon systems and stuff like that, that certainly would free up money to do different things if we had different social priorities. What would you like to see us invest more of our resources, our time, our materials, our expertise, our human capital? What would you like to see happen more if we had less military spending?
Let's put it this way. If we could pick and choose what the government spends its money on, I would love to see more focus on public transportation. Having spent a lot of time in areas with great public transportation, all over the world and in major metropolitan areas in the United States, and then going to areas that do not have great public transportation, we are wasting not only resources like gas, but time and productivity sitting in traffic when we could be moving on, pick a mechanism for getting people around, like trains or something like that. I think we should be spending more time and money on getting people around efficiently so that we can maximize the use of the diminishing resources we have. So how's that for an answer?
Well, it's your answer. I think it's a great answer.
So that's Bruce A., private citizen's opinion right there.
Well, I thank you for calling in your capacity as the commanding officer of the Pacific Missile Range Facility, and also sharing some of your personal opinions as an individual private citizen. I think that it's important for people to understand that military people are people too.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again for joining us here on Kauai Community Radio. It's certainly a pleasure and an honor to have you with us, and I wish you the best of luck in your endeavors.
All right. Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Aloha. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Our next guest is coming up in a few moments. We're going to go to a little musical break, but you're listening to Out of the Box on KKCR, Kauai Community Radio.
Been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. But now on the edge of dawn, there rides a peace train.
Thank you for joining us here on Out of the Box on KKCR. I'm Jonathan Jay, and this is Dave Giroux, my co-host. You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. We're also broadcasting on Oahu at K284AL Haleiwa. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. We're doing a kind of a show with the theme War and Peace on the Garden Island. We just spoke moments ago with the commanding officer of PMRF, the Pacific Missile Range Facility, Bruce Hay, Captain Bruce Hay. And our next guest is going to be Kyle Kajihiro, a longtime peace activist in Hawaii and the Pacific region. Kyle Kajihiro was born and raised on Hawaii. He's a fourth generation Japanese here on the islands. His current work involves research and education and action for the demilitarization of Hawaii and solidarity work with the Native Hawaiian Movement for Sovereignty and Human Rights. He was the former program director for 15 years, from 96 to 2011, for the American Friends Service Committee, Hawaii Area Office, and now is working for Hawaii Peace and Justice, which is the successor organization to to that. He also is a board member of Mana Maoli, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating youth in traditional Hawaiian culture, and works with DMZ Hawaii and Aloha Aina, the Aloha Aina Network. In 2013, Kyle was the recipient of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Peacemaker Award. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us here on Out of the Box. Welcome to KKCR.
Hey, aloha. Thank you for inviting me on.
Well, it's a real pleasure. I don't know if you got a chance to listen to some of the things that Captain Hay was talking about, but tell us about your work. What has been the central driving theme of your efforts?
Sure. I started working at the American Friends Service Committee in 96, as you mentioned. And as folks may know, the AFSC is affiliated with the Quaker religion. So it has a strong commitment to nonviolence and peacemaking.
Sure,
and
also, from a spiritual
quality.
I'm sorry for interrupting you. I was just going to say from a very spiritually grounded place.
That's right. That's right. And so our work in Hawaii since 1968 has been focused on addressing these root causes of war and violence and trying to address them, and with the understanding that there is no real conditions for peace if there are injustices in our community. And so one of the things we realized early on in the work in Hawaii is that we have to address the contradiction of how the military came to be so rooted here, in part through the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom and the taking of Hawaiian lands to use for military preparations. And so when we look at issues like military training, most of the land the military has in Hawaii comes out of the so-called ceded lands, the Hawaiian kingdom lands. And so that's part of our approach, I guess, to understand, what are some of these roots that go back historically, geographically, and then work to address them. And so when I started working for AFSC, one of the first things I got involved in, our program had been working to support the Makua Valley struggle since the 70s.
Where is the Makua Valley?
For folks who aren't familiar, Makua Valley is on the west side of Oahu Island. It's near the end of the road, past Waianae and Makaha. And it's about a 5,000-acre valley. It's really beautiful, undeveloped from Mauka to Makai.
So kind of an old-school ahupua'a then?
It's still an intact ahupua'a. There hasn't been other development. And part of that was in the 40s, the Army basically condemned the land through an executive order during World War II, evicted the families that were living there and in some cases used their homes and buildings as target practice. So that's, some of the historical memory that we try to preserve and the commitment that the Army would clean up and return the land after the war was never fulfilled. And so we work with those communities, and some of those kupuna have passed on, to try to enforce that. And that's one of the issues that is current right now is trying to get the Army to fulfill its commitment to clean up and return Makua Valley. But that's what I came into when I first started working at AFSC, and I soon realized that there were many, many other sites throughout the islands that faced similar kinds of challenges. The other thing that was very important in my own learning was understanding how similar Hawaii was to other places in the world that were dealing with these kinds of issues, such as Okinawa, Guam, the Philippines, and so forth, and that we had to start working together, in solidarity and not in isolation.
Well, what as a peace activist, what motivates you, or maybe I should say, how do you reconcile the idea that many people have that a strong military defense is an important and necessary component of our society, and that without a military defense we would be vulnerable or exposed to attack by other militaries?
Well, I guess I would start by questioning what does defense mean, and when does it become an offensive capability that becomes aggression against other peoples and places. And if you look at Hawaii's history, You know, Hawaii was overthrown in an act of military aggression as part of a bid to expand American power in the Pacific. So it has an imperial component that we can't deny, and it doesn't just go away because the political conditions have changed here. That's part of the deep historical problem that we're addressing, and those contradictions keep coming up when we deal with ceded lands, when we deal with sovereignty issues, when we deal with Hawaiian cultural rights and that sort of thing. Those contradictions are embedded. So anyway, just back to your question, I think we have to ask, like, well, you know, is this really about defense, or is it really about something else? Is it about creating a kind of a dominant world order and to impose a will on other people? Does it result in the loss of rights, the loss of freedoms to peoples who are instrumental to that vision, right? Like a place like Hawaii or Guam Guam is still a colony of the United States, and a military site, a key military site. You know, what are the costs? And I think when you start to look at it from a different perspective of those who are impacted negatively, you see that discussion begins to look a little, that argument that it's about protection, that it's about unnecessary defense, begins to change because we see that there's a huge cost that other people have to bear. We have to ask if that's an ethical kind of a policy to practice.
Well, I think a lot of people are confused about the difference between offense and defense. Even with specific weapon systems, a lot of what is tested at PMRF, those are considered to be theater missile defense systems. But maybe you could explain or share your understanding of the difference between defensive weapon systems that protect against enemy attack and weapon systems that attack an enemy's ability to defend itself.
Right. Well, so that is, I think that's one of the things that is confusing about the terminology missile defense. And some of the activists against these missile systems have begun to use it as a missile, an offensive capability because it's basically, its most strategic use would be as a shield against a counterattack. So it's an ability to neutralize the potential retaliation by another opponent in the case of a U.S. first strike. And if you do that, you change the whole equation of, what had sort of governed the stalemate during the Cold War was the fact that one adversary could annihilate the other, and so therefore both would not make the first move because it would lead to their mutual destruction. That's the MAD, right? Mutually assured destruction.
Yeah, that was a policy that many people considered to be mad.
Mad, exactly. But then, if you change the balance of that equation by saying, well, we could first strike you, and then you can't retaliate because I have a shield now that's already locked onto your offensive, your retaliatory capabilities. That changes the psychology of that arrangement. As crazy as it is, it leads to an arms race, and that's what we're seeing is that Russia feels very much in danger. China is beginning to feel that way. The missile defense systems that are encircling them basically say, well, we could strike you and you can't retaliate. And so it leads to them building up more and more capabilities. And that's what we've been seeing, especially when, the U.S. has basically put first strike on the table as a possible option. And that happened in the Bush administration, that, a preemptive strike is within in the imagination of the policymakers. And that's pretty frightening to think about that.
Well, I guess it's, as you describe it, it could be very destabilizing to, a previously balanced kind of situation.
Right. And not that we would advocate for maintaining the balance of terror in that way. I think the point is to then begin working back from the brink, through diplomacy, through these arms agreements that are supposedly, to outlaw eventually nuclear weapons. And that's one of the issues that in fact, this year is the 5-year review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And part of that was the bargain, the grand bargain in that treaty was that the non-nuclear countries that were aspiring to acquire nuclear weapons would renounce that option. In exchange, the nuclear powers would then begin a serious effort at denuclearizing their arsenals, right? That hasn't happened. And so it's, you know, it's leading to all kinds of other anxieties and unraveling of these agreements. And so, you know, there's a real, in fact, the nuclear powers are upgrading their capabilities.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think budgets for those programs are actually expanding, which is really curious with the rhetoric of the global war on terror, because those are distributed non-state actors that don't have an industrial economy or an infrastructure that you could attack. And so in some ways it seems almost nonsensical to be therefore expanding our nuclear first strike global capability. What do you think is the motivation for that?
Well, you know, if you I like the analysis that Joseph Gerson uses in his book Empire and the Bomb, where he says that the argument that the United States has used nuclear weapons in war only twice, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is actually not true.
How so?
Because the utility of the nuclear weapon is like the utility of a loaded gun that you could aim in a particular direction and you could coerce your target to do things that they wouldn't necessarily want to do.
So like nuclear leverage.
With the threat of a strike. And that's kind of how it's been used in many cases through, you know, that he documents in this book, where there's been near, you know, miscalculations that could have resulted in outbreak of nuclear war, and cases where it was a form of, you know, putting a nuclear gun to your head and saying, well, you know, you're going to do this thing. And so that, in that way, it is being used as a weapon. If you did that to another individual with a loaded gun, that would be a form of assault, right? And so that's...
I would think that would be like terroristic threatening.
Right. I mean, so it's, you know, it is a form of using this threat as a form of leverage, which, has a destabilizing sort of effect. And so I guess that's what the nuclear option enables for the countries that have it, is that now they have something that nobody else does, and they can use it to leverage decisions to whatever way.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Out of the Box on KKCR, Kauai Community Radio. We're speaking with longtime peace activist Kyle Kajihiro about some of the strategic implications of the U.S.'s commitment to a wartime economy, even in times of peace. Today, with the so-called Asian or Pacific pivot, we're seeing a rededication, a refocus, and an expansion of the U.S.'s military scope of operation, forward deployment, infrastructure build-out, resource allocation throughout the Pacific. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I think it's... I think it's dangerous. I think it will have, you know, very tremendous negative impacts on a number of communities throughout the region, and that those voices and those costs and impacts are not really taken into account when the world leaders talk about this pivot, this policy, and what its so-called benefits would be. And usually these impacts fall on smaller, more marginalized sort of places, like Guam, like Okinawa, you know, like the Philippines and Hawaii, that have borne the brunt of military bases, military troops and operations, training, and all of the sort of subsidiary impacts, for more than 100 years. And so it's a remilitarization, but it's not a new policy, I guess. One of the things when I look at it is that it's a continuation or intensification of a process that began more than 100 years ago, with the case of Hawaii being, you know, militarily overthrown, annexed, you know, to create a strategic military outpost. We were the fulcrum of this pivot in 1898, and continue to be a center point of that leverage in this new policy. And what it's, in material terms, what we're seeing is, you know, just an expansion of training facilities and build-ups in and new types of activities in places like Pohapuloa, in Schofield, Lihue, on Oahu, and in Makoa Valley, where we've been able to hold off live fire training for the last 10 years through a lawsuit, through political pressure by the community,
Now there's the potential for the Army to resume live fire training because the courts have basically exhausted their legal route, and that it's going to have to become political again. And this is all being driven by, you know, these policies that we need to train more people into. They want to hold on to as much real estate as they can in a climate where there's shrinking budgets. They don't want to lose any ground. So it creates weird dynamics where stuff that hasn't been used is still being held on to and being banked for something else. And meanwhile, that's being withheld from the community for alternative uses. And that community center has had a vision of restoring cultural practice there, of using it for education, and of returning, you know, the residents who were removed and had lost a lot of things, a lot of their connection to that place, you know, having some sense of closure and justice for them. You know, there's many sites besides Makua. That's just one of the most visible at this time, but we're dealing with other situations in Waikane Valley and other places on the island.
Well, it certainly seems consistent with military doctrine to try and hold on to land once you've gained it. But we've got a caller who's been standing by, who I believe has a comment or a question for you. Aloha, caller. You're on the air. Welcome to Out of the Box with KKCR. We're talking with Kyle Kajihiro, a longtime peace activist based out of Oahu, yeah?
Yeah, hey, Kyle. How's it? This is Raymond Catania.
Terrific.
Hey, how's it? He's saying, hey, how's it? Yeah, yeah, we got to have you on our radio again, our station here. But I'm working with the Oceans for Peace, yeah? And we've been, you know, doing some activities here, educational at this time, and we're going to be having sign holdings pretty soon about exactly what you're talking about with relation to RIMPAC. And like you were talking about, you just mentioned about the military trying to hold on to some of the lands that it's got, like Makua, yeah? You
right.
Know, which has a direct relationship to the wars that America is involved in, like, for example, all the training and live fire and everything that America has been involved in Hawaii on the ceded lands, which is actually Kanaka lands, they use directly in places where they're occupying or they're waging war. But I don't, you know, like, for example, I was reading the Star Advertiser today, and I found something pretty interesting of what's going on in Iraq. And I think it has a lot to do with pivot in the Pacific, that the United States is focusing more on the Pacific now. And it destroyed the hell out of Iraq. And the very people that they say that they're fighting, like Al-Qaeda, is beginning to make moves on taking over that country. You're pretty aware with that. And I think that the U.S. can't really respond because their efforts are in the Pacific now. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been that drawdown, right, in Iraq, and supposedly the war is over, but, you know, if you ask people there, it doesn't seem to be over. And
well, what do they know? I mean, you know.
But, I think it's not like we would advocate for a prolonged occupation of these countries, but it's just to show that those policies have this kind of blowback that can't be contained or controlled, right? And the fact that September 11 happened in 2001 was blowback from similar kind of policies, you know, decades earlier, right? With sort of arming the Mujahideen against the Soviets, basically funding, you know, insurgent movement that became the Taliban. So, you know, I think we need a different kind of basis for establishing peace and security that isn't about the overwhelming use of force to occupy and try to squash resistance. I mean, the resistance is happening in part because of the kind of unjust policies that have happened historically. So not to say that, you know, those tactics, we would embrace the kind of tactics of Al-Qaeda, but it's understandable where they draw their strength from. Certain historical grievances, right?
So, I agree. I think, like, for example, what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's all blowback, U.S. foreign policy. And Hawaii has been historically used, as a training ground for America's military exploits around the world. And it's beginning to bite them in the Middle East as they begin to ramp up their presence here in the Pacific. And what they always depend upon is giving a few people jobs. Like you talked, Bruce Kay talked about giving 1,000 people jobs as their social basis, you know, for continuing this thing and getting support in the community. But Jonathan Jay asked a real important question of Hay and asked him as a personal opinion what you would rather see the money spent on, and he said public transportation.
Yeah, that's why we played Peace Train, because I thought that
And we would rather see, the military budget spent on other things to employ people, you know.
But that's right. I mean, you know, I guess it's kind of why everything gets funneled through the military when it really is, if it's about creating jobs and infrastructure or whatever, those kind of projects, right? If it's about environmental restoration, fund those programs that can employ people in restoring the environment. You know, God knows we need help to, you know, maintain ecosystems and clean up contamination. And, you know, could the infrastructure at a base like PMRF or at, like, say, Barbara's Point, where they closed down several years ago, could those things have been envisioned as a transitional sort of facility that would help incubate new industries and economics for Hawaii based on sustainable energy or something like that, right? Create that capacity as opposed to investing in just, you know, more construction, more homes. And that's what we're seeing on Oahu, is just like massive, you know, construction of stuff that's basically to hold the military's footprint here, even beyond the sequestration and fiscal problems, you know, and even I think it was an anticipation of Inouye's eventual retirement or passing, that there would be at least that investment would be holding them here. But really, is that the best thing for Hawaii? If it's about our economic development, why don't we have plans for that as opposed to, you know, this addiction to military spending?
Thank you for calling in.
An addiction to war. We've got to have constant war. I'm 64 years old, and I don't remember a moment of peace. In all the time that I've been around, America's always waging a war someplace, and we have to reorient the economy and do other things, like you said, cultural restoration, transportation, the building of homes, alternative forms of energy like solar and all kinds of things that we have to redirect our forces to and not depend upon militarism for employing our people.
Thank you for calling in, caller. I want to appreciate you for that.
I'm going to hang up now and listen, but I really appreciate you getting Kyle on. And too bad we don't have the both of them together in the station where we could have a real head-on debate, because Kyle can really lay out what's going on very clearly, you know, and get away from the pomp and circumstance of what's going on. So thank you very much, Jonathan, for a great show, and I'm going to continue to listen. Thank you.
Sure. Well, I appreciate that.
I want to just, if I could just... comment on something Ray said too. I think is a really important point.
Please do.
That we have there's an ethical dimension too of, you know, and my colleague Terry Kiko'olani always reminds us about this. He's like, what is our kuleana when those wars emanate from Hawaiian lands, where the techniques and technologies of killing and waging these wars are perfected and practiced here, and then goes out and it gets used against other people, right, to occupy their lands. What is the obligation, you know, to us in Hawaii to speak to that? And so it can't be just a discussion about, well, it's just jobs. You know, there's an ethical dimension that we have to consider. And I think that, you know, some of the work that Kerry does, they just had a women's retreat to discuss the problem of militarism and what does real security, what does genuine security mean, you know, as opposed to a sort of military national security. How do communities define security based on, you know, we have food and shelter and basic needs met, we have an environment that's cared for and can sustain life, we have cultural integrity and, you know, safe communities where we're not threatened by these institutions and their social, you know, collateral damage that happens, such as the, you know, the kind of sexual violence that's often surrounds these large bases. And so, you know, those are really important discussions that we reframe, you know, even what the terms are, and so we don't get caught in that bind of, well, national security is it for defense, you know, there are other voices and other perspectives that need to be taken into account.
Well, it seems like that's a cycle that really feeds quite profitably on itself. How would you like to see us turn our attention to a different path?
I think it's
where does that start?
More people to be involved in this discussion. I don't have all the answers, but I think that if we don't start to at least consider how do we take care of those needs and develop real security, a genuine security for us, but based on meeting human needs and the environment, we won't get there. We just keep going for the short-term fix, which is, you know, just more spending. Oh, you need more land? Sure, we'll give you more land, right? Like the 25,000 acres that were taken for the Stryker Brigade. I think if we start to say, like, let's look at this economy and what's Hawaii need? We're talking about, there's a lot of discussion of food security and food sovereignty. Well, should we, you know, really try to invest in that capability so that we can not be so dependent on these, you know, chemical agribusiness companies coming in and basically dominating politics? Or, you know, if we really want to invest in job creation in depressed communities, let's create a fund that actually helps to retrain and develop those skill sets. You know, can environmental restoration be a kind of skill set that Hawaii excels in and can help other parts of the world, you know, with the cleanup? And we have thousands of sites to practice on, at least with military contaminated sites. And often what I'm seeing is that a lot of those contractors are coming from continent. You know, there's very few local people who are trained to actually take advantage of these jobs that are created in environmental restoration. And when it's the people that created the contamination are also able to benefit from the cleanup spending. And really we should be thinking about how does that money get reinvested in local communities that are getting displaced by the shifting economy. Those are some of the immediate things that I start, you know, to look at. I get frustrated when I see that some cleanup efforts are happening in places like Waikane and other sites such as in Pearl Harbor, but these are for the most part just to maintain the status quo. They're not really about helping our communities to develop in a way that gives more autonomy and options for the future, you know.
Well, if you're just tuning in right now, we're talking with Kyle Kajihiro, a longtime peace activist here in Hawaii. I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon and sharing some of your perspective, some of your values, the way that you look at where solutions could come from. And I wanted to invite you, if you had any closing comments or kind of a takeaway for the listener that you wanted to share.
Well, I guess I want to invite folks to raise your voices. If you are concerned about this turn of the U.S. government towards ever increasing militarization, then please, you know, add your voice to the opposition. Join with folks who are the Oceans for Peace, Hawaii Alliance for Justice and Peace, and other groups that are speaking out and trying to raise our visibility of other opportunities. Right, we don't have these opportunities until we start to create them and demand them. And so it really needs more of those voices. And I think the GMO movement on Kauai and Maui and Hawaii Island, this food security movement is really inspiring to the rest of us because it's showing that grassroots power can really have some impact. So let's also look at that there's these other impacts of militarization that is linked. You know, these things are linked in so many ways. And at PMRF, you see these linkages with the GMO companies in the surrounding fields around the Pacific Missile Range, which basically provide a buffer to the base. And that was included as part of a condition on the land itself by the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And so there's this kind of collaboration that just cements it in place. They start questioning that, they start demanding real alternatives, and raise your voice in protest when you can.
Well, thank you for joining us in our discussion on war and peace on the Garden Island. Really appreciate that, Kyle.
Thank you. Thanks for organizing this, Jonathan.
Oh, my pleasure. Just trying to do service to the community, get issues out, and help raise awareness on all sides, really.
Yep. Great.
We're going to go to a short musical break, and we'll be back with journalist John Lettman, who's written extensively about politics, people, and plants in the Pacific region. Here's a little bit of Police, Invisible Sun. Aloha, and thank you for joining us today on Out of the Box. I'm Jonathan Jay with Dave Giroux, fantastic engineer and co-host.
Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to toss in a gratuitous compliment to you, Dave.
Gratuitous, that means it's good?
It means it's gravy.
Okay.
We've been talking about war and peace in the Pacific, specifically in the Garden Island here in the Pico, in the center of the Pacific Ocean. Our next guest is John Lettman, a Kauai-based independent journalist who writes about politics, people, and plants in Asia and the Pacific region. He's written for local publications in Hawaii, as well as international media outlets like Interpress, Service News Agency, Truthout.org, Al Jazeera, Foreign Policy in Focus, and many others. While John will claim not to be an expert in any of these things, he does have a very curious mind, and he's an excellent writer. So welcome to the show, John Lettman. Thanks for joining us here on Out of the Box. Really appreciate you coming into the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to speak with you, Jonathan.
Is it? That's great.
It certainly is.
Well, did you get a chance to listen to what Captain Bruce and Mr. Kajihiro had to say in their perspectives on war and peace? You're a journalist. You sort of come to these issues from your own place. How do you see these things?
I did listen to most of the show, and I did hear both of them, and I have spoken with both of them before, both nice guys, and it's nice to hear from them directly. I think it's something that everybody, especially here on Kauai and here in Hawaii, it's worth giving more thought to. I don't know how much people give to this in their daily lives, some more than others, I suppose, but it's something that's going on, and as I think Kyle had pointed out, it's happening all over the world. I'm talking about various military endeavors, and as has been pointed out, we really have a central role, despite being, you know, we're a pretty small island with 65,000 or so people, but we play this outsized role in all of this. And so I think it's worth digging a little deeper for everybody. If you're already paying attention, pay closer attention. If you're not paying attention at all, maybe it's a good time to start.
Where do you begin in a topic like this? Because the issues are so large. You're talking about basically over half the planet. and approximately half of the federal budget, you know. These are huge issues. These are massive issues. They're not anything that started yesterday or the week before. This has been going on for a while. Where do you begin? How do you approach? Where do you start to understand these things?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, considering that the ocean seems like this big empty space, it is vast, and it's deep. The deeper you go, the more you find. And so I think a good place to start with anything is just somewhere that you're interested in. If you're interested in, you know, deep sea resource extraction, start there. If you're interested in the impact of military bases, start there. If you're interested in the environment, start there. If you're interested in the ocean, start with ocean-related matters, something that's interesting to you so that you're going to pursue it further. And, yeah, you can't know everything. You can't cover everything. You can't follow everything. But you can at least get a general sense of what's happening. One thing that's on my mind a lot.
That was exactly what I was going to ask you.
a couple things. One is connecting the dots and seeing, you know, where we fit in this greater picture, because, you know, we're kind of focused on what we're doing here, as everybody is. And yet because we are the head of Pacific Command, much of what's happened here, much of the testing and the training, at least in terms of military endeavors, that goes on here goes out to other places and it impacts other people.
We're kind of the hub of a big, big wheel.
We are. And as I think Kyle was pointing out, you know, places are Pacific neighbors, which are, they're far away, but they have a lot in common with us. And he pointed out Okinawa, and he mentioned Guam. I think he may or may not have spoken a little bit about Jeju Island, which is in South Korea. And he mentioned the Philippines. And I would also throw in there the Marshall Islands. And while these are all very diverse and different places, different from each other and different from Hawaii in some ways, they also have a lot in common. And so I think a good place to start is to kind of take a look at some of these places and ask yourself, you know, what's going on there? What are the struggles that they face? And is there any overlap with what's happening here?
What do you see as some of those connections?
Well, an obvious one is the military, because all of these places are heavily militarized. Hawaii, obviously, is a major military place.
I think it's the most militarized state in the nation.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you're measuring and how you measure that. But, yeah, you could make that argument for sure, especially considering the size of land we have here. But, obviously, land is not the only thing that we use for various military endeavors, as Captain Hay had pointed out, you know, the ocean and the sea. So, but yeah, Okinawa, for example, and you look at Okinawa, they have, and Jeju Island in South Korea, they have very strident protests.
Help us understand a little bit about what those places are like. I think Jeju Island or Guam or Okinawa, those are all very far away and dimly understood.
Well, far away perhaps, but I mean, I don't know. I don't think of them as really that far away to me. I mean, maybe in terms of miles or hours in an airplane. But if you look at the cultures that have come to Hawaii over the last 150 years and much longer, of course, the Hawaiian people themselves, and you look at the cultures and the lifestyles of the people there, I think you see a lot of connections. So that, to me, they don't really feel far away at all. And you look at some of the things that are happening there, the various struggles in Okinawa, and you look at their approach to the challenges that they're facing, I think there's some lessons to be learned. Okinawa and Jeju in particular have very, you know, big protests and very strong protests against what's happening there.
What exactly are they protesting against? What is happening there?
Well, I mean, take Okinawa, for example. You know, I want to get this right, but I think it's something like 75% of all the forces, 75% of all the U.S. forces in Japan, which is a lot. It's something like, I'll venture to say 50,000, but I'm not sure about that. But it's a lot of people. They're all concentrated in Okinawa, and Okinawa is to Japan in some ways what Hawaii is to the United States. We're this kind of small, remote island area where a huge number of military forces are gathered. So in Okinawa, they have a lot of the problems that you might associate with big military presence, like lots of noise from airplanes flying over, various incidents. They have, of course, a large number of foreign forces, those being U.S. forces there. And so they're dealing with various crime issues, sexual violence, you know, fights in public.
Why do those things seem to go hand in hand with military bases? I mean, what is special about a military base? So the majority of those people, I'm sure, are decent, good people. Who love their families and are dedicated to their work. Why is there often these issues that keep coming up associated with military bases?
That's a big question and a complicated question, probably with a lot of different reasons for why that might be. I don't know if I want to go down that path right here, but you can imagine that we're setting ourselves up for a lot of conflict in Okinawa, where you have people who are unfamiliar with the culture and perhaps isolated from the culture in some ways, depending on what the situation is at the time. But you have all these different forces coming together in Okinawa, and the Okinawan people have made it really clear they don't want to be occupied any longer. You know, John McCain was criticized a few years ago. He was on, I think it was Meet the Press or Face the Nation, something like that, and he was saying, you know, he said, you know, does the U.S. have to stay in Iraq for 100 years? And the commentator came back and kind of questioned that. And he said, well, how long do we have to stay in Okinawa? How long do we have to stay in Korea? He said, you know, they welcome our presence and no one complains. Well, that's a pretty remarkable statement.
You think that's not accurate?
Well, read the newspaper. You know, go online. I mean, social media is a great way to explore some of these issues. And then maybe it's an easy way for people who are intimidated by a lot of, you know, sometimes reading through really dry government-issued reports that could kind of, your eyes glaze over and you see a 300-page report full of statistics. But a good way to step into it, and this is, I'm kind of venturing away from Okinawa, but because we're talking about some of these broader Pacific issues, RIMPAC, for example, follow these different places on social media. Go on Facebook or go on Twitter or go on Instagram and search for Okinawa, search for Jeju, search for Guam, or for that matter, search for RIMPAC, because RIMPAC 2014 is there. And just like RIMPAC 2012, they have a presence, and they'll be posting, you know, they're going to be updating the world on what they're doing.
I wonder whose job it is to update the RIMPAC Facebook page.
Well, they obviously have, you know, media people who are in charge of, you know, sharing images and messages, and they want to be able to control the message, and they also want to be able to communicate what's happening. And so I think that's a good way, we're kind of moving away from your original question, but I think that's a good way for people, you know, you ask how, where can they start? Something simple like that. And again, to kind of go on with this RIMPAC question, take a look at the images that you see, because RIMPAC, once it begins in June 26th, I believe it is, through August 1st, they're going to be updating their images and putting up photos and
sending out tweets.
Exactly, and they'll be sharing information. And I think anyone, as an ordinary citizen, you can go and you can look at these images and you can read about it for yourself, maybe in a very simple, kind of easy way to digest. And you can, you know, it'll resonate with you in one way or another. Maybe you'll be, you know, you'll think, hey, that's cool, great, strong defense.
Yeah, you can befriend the military there.
Exactly.
Hey, John, we got a caller on the phone who'd like to ask you a question. Do you
have
a couple minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, caller, you're on the air.
I'm on the air.
Just have a few minutes left in the show.
This is Gordon Ledetz from Oceans for Peace Coalition, and I'm so proud that you guys put on this show. Thank you, KKCR, for informing the community. And
if you could be quick there, we just got a few minutes left.
Although we love praise, don't be shy with that. The thing I need to answer is the captain who said that the base adds all this military money to our economy. It adds money to the California economy and the Arizona economy. I live in Kekaha, and I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of people who work in the base don't live here. There's a subway out there and a gym and a bunch of offices. But the bulk of the people who work at the base come here for 3 months, 6 months, sometimes as long as a year, and then they leave. And their paychecks don't, well, yeah, they spend some money here, but that's an industrial park. That's not a military base. And for him to say that there's 1,000 people maybe over a year period there might be 1,000 people, but not at any one time. So, you know, liars figure his figures lie. I'm not calling the captain a liar. I know he's just using the military statistics, but as somebody who lives here, I can tell you that the base doesn't provide very many local jobs. That's just nonsense. And by the way, the same is true for the GMO companies. The guys who work in the fields come from Latin America, and the scientists come from California. They're not going to stay here forever either. So thanks for letting me clear that up.
Okay.
And,
did you have a question?
I really just want to just thank the speaker about telling us about Okinawa. We learned a lot at the Oceans for Peace teach-in the other day about Okinawa, and we saw a picture of 100,000 people demonstrating against the U.S. base. And I never read about that in the papers. Thank you for informing us on that.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
That's it. I'm signing off. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much, caller.
John, we just have a few minutes left then. Do you have any closing remarks then on
the topic? We were just starting.
Well, there's only 7 minutes left in the show. And,
Yeah.
Well, we do have still several minutes left.
Well,
so.
let's go to get one more phone call.
What? Well,
hello, caller. You're on the air.
I guess we're doing a phone call.
Yes, I'm Catherine Music calling in.
If you could make a quick question here of John, then.
Give him a chance to respond.
Hello?
Hello, I'm Catherine Music, a marine biologist. I lived in Okinawa, and I wrote the environmental impact assessment for Jeju, and I lived in Puerto Rico when Vieques was being bombed, and so now I'm interested in RIMPAC. And I was calling in to ask the gentleman in charge of PMR if what would happen if they put the water back. If they were no longer there, we would have the place back like it was pre-plantation, and then we could be more sustainable. And also wanted to ask whether the money that is being supposedly spent by the 1,000 people, isn't that our own taxpayer money that we've given them and it's coming back? My question was, I don't have a question.
Those are certainly good observations.
They have 24 ospreys there. They're having a big march this Saturday. They are so against the military there. It's right, 75% of the people are against the military presence there. And so the question is, what can we do against something that we believe is not moral? We have to change the paradigm. And I just want to comment that I think you're right. Follow something you love. I love the ocean, and so I became a marine biologist. And every island I've lived on has had this problem. So no more than that is a comment. Right? Okinawans are generally against the presence there. In Jeju, they've already been destroyed. The corals there have been destroyed for the American military base, and it's being built by Samsung. So it's a military-industrial complex. It's very hard to beat, but we have to change it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Yep. Thank you.
I wish we had more time to cover these issues. They're so intertwined and so interconnected and so vast. You wanted to make a point a moment ago, John.
Oh. Well, I was gonna. You know, Kyle earlier was speaking about the Pacific pivot, and I think you'd ask Captain Hay too, about redirecting our resources and our forces to the Asia-Pacific region, and certainly that's happening. We're forging new military agreements with Vietnam, with Australia since 2011, now with Myanmar, and then just a few weeks ago we signed a 10-year agreement that'll allow U.S. military forces to operate from Filipino bases. And so we're kind of moving back in to places we hadn't been before, places we haven't been for a while. But one thing that strikes me, and perhaps it strikes some of your listeners too, is that at the same time, we're also ramping up our presence in Africa. If you follow news, just general daily international news.
I try not to, actually.
Well, you might want to. But, in Africa, we're stepping up our forces there a lot. And also in Europe, President Obama was just in Poland announcing $1 billion and increased training. We just sent a pair of B-2 bombers to England. Some of this is in response to what's happening in Crimea and the Ukraine. You know, how many pivots can we afford? Meanwhile, we've got Iraq unraveling before our eyes and the war in Afghanistan, which is apparently ending. we're going to be staying there through 2015, and who knows what will happen when the new president's in.
So yeah.
You can only divide your resources and your war-making ability so far.
Well, it seems like...
This is going on.
Yeah, it seems like at least for the time being, the U.S. military is focusing their efforts just on this one planet.
Well, yeah, so far. But, I mean, and then that comes back to PMRF, because if you want to look at what's happening in space, you can look into writer and activist, Bruce Gagnon, you may have heard of. He's does a lot of work looking at the militarization of space, and that ties right back into what's happening here at the Pacific Missile Range Facility, soon to be called the Inouye Pacific Range Facility.
Yeah, it's going to be rebranded.
Well, you'll notice, and this is a question that I had, was why we're calling it that. The Inouye, of course, to honor Senator Inouye, but the Inouye Pacific Range Facility. We could probably take out one of those superfluous words and just call it the Inouye Pacific Missile Range and still get the point across and still convey what happens here. But that's maybe a topic for another day.
Yeah,
so anyway,
well,
I would just encourage people to kind of pay closer attention and find something that really interests you and pursue it. There are a lot of different ways to get information and to educate yourself. And again, just follow, for example, RIMPAC 2014. Follow it on social media, and you'll have a reaction. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. Whatever it might be, it's going to speak to you. Those images, those words, and you'll ask yourself, you know, is this Malama Aina, or is this, you know, Bamna Aina? I mean, you can tell yourself. I mean, there's a reason they call them war games. They're not called peace games. So just follow things more closely and see where it leads you.
John, well, thank you very much for being on the show here. We do wish we had more time, and looking at your credentials here, I'm impressed with that you're right here on Kauai, and I hope to get you back on the show here again.
Well, and just as long as I'm, passing out compliments to people, I will say that I think you're a damn fine writer.
Well, I appreciate it. It's nice to I catch your show, and I enjoy it, too, and I like to speak with you gentlemen, and if these are important issues, I'm glad that you're taking this up. So.
We had somebody call in a little while ago and said he was really disappointed in us, in Jonathan and I, when we had Captain Hay on because we didn't ask him the hard-hitting questions. You know, why are you selling weapons of mass destruction here on the island? You're testing them for sale around the world, you know, and, you know, we should have asked them those hard-hitting questions, you know. As well, our answer to that was right after we got after he was on the air, we got Kyle Kajihiro, peace and social justice activist, and then you, independent journalist, to, you know, bring the other side of the story. So that's how we get, you know, the
diversity,
full story out to everybody.
Balance, media balance.
Yeah, right. And this is not a one-time discussion. These are things that should be discussed ongoing. So if this hasn't been part of your discussion before, maybe it'll start to be from now.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much then.
Thank you, guys.
Aloha. Okay, well, time to turn the board over to Mose.
I should say real quickly, I have an announcement here to make. I was talking with Beth Tokioka earlier this morning, and she wanted me to make sure that I mentioned Tropic Care Kauai 2014. That's medical care at no cost. That's June 16th through the 26th. There'll be sites on all different parts of the island, the west, central, and the east, all ages, free of charge. I encourage you to go online to kauai.gov, where I think you can find out more.
Aloha. See you back here in 2 weeks.
Ah, hui ho.